Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Architect Daniel Liebskind's master plan for the World Trade Center site brought hope to a battered New York and nation. He promised to fill a 16-acre void with five towers that wrapped around a sunken memorial garden. New York turned to Liebskind, the Polish-American immigrant son of Holocaust survivors, to help heal its wounds and rebuild, to bring bustling new offices, shops, and restaurants to a city still mourning but ready to look ahead. The plan's tallest tower, the Freedom Tower, would soar 1,776 feet, tallest in the world because, explained Liebskind, 1776 was the year Americans signed the Declaration of Independence. But one man's vision would not stop commercial developers, politicians, victims' families, and other architects from plunging in on this epic project. The battle over the design at Ground Zero has been fierce. Liebskind sees New York as home turf. He's determined to see his towers built. He's been in epic battles before and prevailed with startling, thought-provoking, and beautiful buildings. Tonight on Point, Daniel Liebskind, his embattled plan for Lower Manhattan, and his adventures in life and architecture. We begin in New York with the latest twists in the redevelopment of the World Trade Center site. Blair Goldson is economic development reporter at the New York Observer and joins us now. Blair, thanks for being with us tonight.
No problem, Tom.
Can you bring us up to date on where this stands? We've seen the saga, some of us from the front row in New York, some of us from afar. Where does the redevelopment plan stand? Is it settled at last?
I wouldn't say it's quite settled yet, in order to really understand the whole context of the situation, really got to step back to a couple of years ago. It really all started back in July 2001 when the developer Larry Silverstein got a 99-year lease on the World Trade Center site. And about 6 weeks later, the terrorist attack destroyed the building, right, and he had to rebuild. I could go on with the context unless you want to start with more recent stuff.
No, that's good. Then, of course, they put out they invited designs for a master plan. Daniel Liebskind, who we'll speak with in a moment, was one of those. Just came out the winner.
Correct. There was a little bit of controversy there because Governor Pataki actually overruled the committee of the a committee in the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation, which was the state agency that was created to oversee the redevelopment of Lower Manhattan, and no one exactly knows why the governor did it, but suspicions run that it might have had something to do with that the Liebskinds hired an old law school classmate of Pataki's, a guy named Eddie Hayes, and he may have had some influence there, but really no one knows.
Now, Pataki overruled the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation to decide what?
To decide basically that Daniel Liebskind would become the master planner of the World Trade Center site over the other finalists in the competition, which was comprised of a few other big-name architects.
But, of course, as it turned out, this was not a happy marriage.
No.
Larry Silverstein and Daniel Liebskind by any measure.
No, not by any measure. Before coming onto the World Trade Center site, Daniel Liebskind had never really done anything close to the nature of this. Not that anyone really has, but
in its scale,
right? He was primarily known for having done the Berlin, the Jewish
Museum in Berlin. Yeah,
and he was known as a brilliant thinker and iconoclast, but he had never really done huge development projects like this. So Larry Silverstein, the leaseholder on the site, was pretty skeptical of Liebskind's abilities to pull something like this off. So Silverstein hired his own longtime collaborating architect, David Childs of the white shoe firm Skidmore, Owings & Merrill. And what happened was that in July 2003, Governor Pataki brokered a truce between Liebskind and David Childs that gave Childs basically 51% to 49% of the say in how the Freedom Tower on the site was going to be developed. So basically, Libeskind was relegated to being a collaborating architect compared to Childs, who was the lead architect.
Blair Goldson, when you look at Daniel Libeskind's original master plan proposal here, the sort of high concept for this site, and the designs that are now the operative designs, we'll ask Daniel Libeskind himself this, but to your eye, how close or how far from the original plan is the working design?
Well, it's interesting because the thing that not many people realize about the master plan is that the master plan was actually just an urban planning document. It was basically supposed to specify things like where street intersections go and how many buildings should be on the site and vaguely how they should be configured. But it wasn't necessarily supposed to specify how the particular skyscrapers would be designed. Now, the public didn't necessarily know that, and they sort of thought that the master plan was supposed to look exactly, or the buildings themselves were supposed to look exactly as they were presented in February 2003 by Daniel Libeskind. However, the master planner doesn't necessarily get to build those buildings. And
all that said, how close is the working design that the cornerstone was laid for on July 4th?
Well, it actually owes a lot more to David Childs' influence than Daniel Libeskind's, and I think Daniel would be the first one to admit that. It's a much bulkier tower, much less asymmetrical, which is what Libeskind wanted. It has a few of the key elements Libeskind wanted, i.e. the 1,776 feet symbolic height, a spire that vaguely echoes the Statue of Liberty. Mm. But when the design for the Freedom Tower was actually unveiled, Libeskind distanced himself from it, and he said, I'm not the architect of this building. You really have to talk to David Childs about that.
Blair, finally, when will we see construction cranes there? When will this project be complete?
Well, the cornerstone was just laid, but a lot of people really viewed that as basically symbolic action. Some people thought that Pataki wanted that in place before the Republican National Convention. It's suffice it to say it's going to take several years, and knowing the New York real estate community, it could take many more than that. It's just hard to say.
So no date definite, but things are moving. Blair Goldson, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
No problem.
Blair Goldson is economic development reporter at the New York Observer. He spoke with me from New York. We're talking tonight with Daniel Libeskind, master plan architect for the World Trade Center site. You can join the conversation. Have you seen the design for New York's Freedom Tower and the rebuilding of 9/11's Ground Zero? Does it look like genius to you or a compromised plan? Should one man be given free rein to reshape a city's skyline? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Daniel Libeskind, principal design architect for Studio Daniel Libeskind, which won the World Trade Center site design competition in February 2003. Libeskind's buildings include the Jewish Museum, Berlin, and the Imperial War Museum North in Manchester, England. Museums of his design are currently under development in Denver, Toronto, and San Francisco. Many more projects as well. His new book is Breaking Ground, Adventures in Life and Architecture. Good evening and welcome, Daniel Libeskind.
Good evening. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for being with us. And what a fascinating life story, not to mention this epic battle that you've just come through or perhaps are still in the last rounds of. Daniel Libeskind, you say right at the beginning of this book that a great building, like great literature or poetry or music, can tell the story of the human soul. What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is something very simple, that a building is not just a bunch of steel and glass and concrete, but it is a medium of communicating history, communicating memory, speaking to a future that is open. And that's really the historical value of architecture. It's not about buildings just being enclosed and providing sort of functional relationships only. It is about building as part of a civic art.
Civic art, and that with a soul beyond what's physically visible. You say from the ruins of Byzantium to Chinese pagodas, the Eiffel Tower, every building tells a story, Daniel Libeskind. And you say when we consider history, what we see before us are the buildings. You know, think of the French Revolution, you think of Versailles, Rome, the Colosseum. What will the buildings of New York say to historians one day? What will they symbolize?
Well, I think New York symbolizes and is really the capital of the free world. I think that's why the terrorists attacked New York. It was not just an attack against America. It was an attack against the free world. And what people will see looking at New York is an aspiration. It's a spiritual mission, not just an economic imperative that drives the development, but a kind of action, a kind of energy that is second to none.
And that growing out of commerce or out of architect's design or the intersection of those two?
It grows out of the heart of reality. Who knows where it grows out? Everyone contributes to it. If you really think about it, a city is kind of a collective work of art done across a long period of time, and every citizen in some way is a contributor to that work of art. We don't usually think of cities as works of art because they're always dynamic and moving forward, but that's what they are. When we look at cities that are sort of finished and just museum cities, like, let's say, Venice, we look at them as artworks, and I think that's the beauty of dynamic cities, that they are artworks in progress.
We're going to come to the artwork that you've worked so hard to plant in Lower Manhattan. But it's a fascinating life story that you've got as well. An architect all your adult life, but didn't have a building of yours actually built until you were 52 years old. Now, that has changed. 6 years later, you've got dozens of projects underway. Tell us about that long life in architecture before something was actually built. What were you doing?
And my wife, Nina, calls me a late bloomer. And, you know, people think, was I wasting my time? But, you know, I was on a different path. I started as a virtuoso musician, and I got interested in drawing and in the sciences and in literature. And I discovered drawing, and I thought through drawing and through meditation and through constructing models and experiments, one could also delve into architecture. And, of course, I was lucky that quite late in my life I won a competition for a building of the Jewish Museum, which was, of course, nothing that went to my head, because I know that winning a competition is usually a ticket to oblivion. But I stuck with it, and the Jewish Museum was my first building, and I'm lucky because now I have many, many very fascinating buildings and sites that I'm working around the world.
It's quite a list. Museums in Toronto, San Francisco, Dresden, Copenhagen, Denver, university building in Hong Kong, student centers in Tel Aviv and North London, a big project in Milan. It's pretty incredible how this has exploded in such a brief period after all those years.
Yeah, I've been I'm a lucky man. But, you know, architecture is bigger than we think, because it's part of the humanities. Most people think architecture is about plumbing and technology and electricity. And it is, of course, about all that. But historically, architecture is one of the liberal arts. It's actually the mother of the arts, as people used to think in ancient times, because it combines knowledge of music, knowledge of mathematics, knowledge of poetry, memory of history, and all that goes to make a building. And unless buildings reflect the passion of society, the passion of culture, they will only be useless objects very soon.
And we'll come to the details, but as it's turned out, and you look at what is going to be built in Lower Manhattan on Ground Zero, on the World Trade Center site, how close is it to your vision, your inspiration, to what you hoped would rise there?
It's very close. You know, of course, there are critics and skeptics and all sorts of experts that will give their opinion. But I believe that what is being developed at Ground Zero is really a vision that was fundamental to my having the good fortune to win this competition for the World Trade Center site. And that winning was not just about an individual winning a competition. It was also about America, because as an immigrant who came here as a teenager, August 28, 1959, was walking by my mother, and with my sister, we stood bleary-eyed at 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning, coming into the harbor of New York on that ship with hundreds of other immigrants, looking at the Statue of Liberty. To me, this was not just the skyline of Manhattan, architecturally, aesthetically beautiful, but it was an experience that I will never forget, because that statue and what that skyline really embodied was the meaning of what good world is. It was about liberties which we never had in Poland. It's about freedoms that you only dreamt about. It was about making yourself a better person, being able to be educated. And that's what I thought is the essence to be embodied in Ground Zero, in the buildings, in the spirit of the site, because so many people perished there, and the sadness of that event, the fact that these heroes of 9/11 will forever be part of New York, and at the same time, out of those ashes will rise something that I think will be inspiring and will be related to what I just mentioned, not just metaphorically, linguistically, but really in space.
In space, high above Manhattan and on the ground. We're going to come back and hear more about the quite incredible life of Daniel Liebskind, master plan architect for the rebuilding of the World Trade Center site in New York. You can join the conversation tonight. Have you seen the design for New York's Freedom Tower and the rebuilding of the World Trade Center site? Does it look like genius to you, like compromised genius? And what do you hear in Daniel Liebskind's philosophy of architecture? Is a battle to defend an architect's vision inevitable in such a public structure? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can look at images of Liebskind's World Trade Site rendering in Jewish Museum Berlin at our website, onpointradio.org, or join us right here, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Daniel Liebskind, master planned architect for the rebuilding of the World Trade Center site in New York, author of the new book, Breaking Ground, Adventures in Life and Architecture. You can join our conversation tonight. Should one man be given free rein to reshape a city's skyline? Is that the path to transcendent design? Is it too much to ask of the World Trade Center project? And New Yorkers in particular, do you feel you're getting what the city needs, what it deserves in Lower Manhattan? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Daniel Liebskind, we want to dive into this design, in particular in Lower Manhattan, but I think it's important to understand a bit more about your life first. Born in Poland, then off to Israel, and then, as you described, at 13, an immigrant to the United States, really a nomadic life, in your word.
Well, it's not unlike many Americans. America is a country of immigrants. It's a country of working people, and my parents were working people. They were happy and lucky to, after all their suffering in their lives, prison camps under the Nazis, under the Soviets, to come to a country that they truly appreciated. And as hard as a life they had, my mother worked in a sweatshop, and my father hauled paper to a printing factory on Stone Street. They loved this country, and they believed that this country and its democracy represents all that's good in the world. And what I want to really say is that this is not about some master planner sitting up in an ivory tower shaping Manhattan. It's about how do you make something which is meaningful work? How do you bring consensus? How do you also compromise? It's not a dirty word in my vocabulary. Mm. How do you make things happen that are meaningful, profound, and at the end beautiful because they represent the public will?
You mentioned architecture before as the mother of arts. Your own mother played a huge role. You describe her coming home from the sweatshop jobs, dyeing fur collars, sewing them onto coats. You were living then in the Amalgamated Clothing Workers Union Housing Cooperative in the Bronx.
Right.
And you were obsessed with pencil drawing, drawing of all kinds. And she said, what are you doing? You want to be an artist and end up starving? You said, Ma, I can be successful. Look at Andy Warhol. And her advice then?
Her advice was to every, you know, successful artist, there are 1,000 starving artists. And she said, you know, you should get trade. You should have a profession. And she said, you know, be an architect because you can always be an artist in architecture, but you cannot be an architect in art. And that was a wise piece of advice because she was a practical but also a very radical woman. And she gave me, I think, advice which I've heeded because architecture is both a craft, a technical know-how, a trade, but it also has that poetry that brings it close to the spiritual soul.
You were living in Berlin on 9/11/01, and you write that you were immediately transfixed by the images of that day, and as soon as the rebuilding began to be discussed, immediately drawn to doing, you had an intuitive feel for what should be there.
Well, I didn't start thinking of architecture and projects. Who could think of architecture and projects when people were still lying in the ashes? Who could be so cruel as to think that architecture is the answer? But I suffered with other people, and I thought, what does this mean for the world? What does this mean for America? This devastation, this kind of void created in the center of the greatest city. And I thought, I've got to do something. I didn't really know what it was, but I was determined that I was coming back, if not to the Bronx, to the Lower Manhattan, and to contribute something. And I was lucky that later on I was phoned and asked, would I like to be on a jury of the competition? I said, what a lucky strike. I turned to my friends. You know, I've been given a chance to be on the jury to select the project to be chosen. But I couldn't make the schedule. It was impossible. And I made a desperate call to Alex Garvin at the LMDC. And I said, look, can you reschedule? Because it's the most important thing I'll ever do in my life. And he said, no, Mr. Liebskind, the date is fixed. And if you can't, why don't you just maybe apply for the competition?
And you did. Your family.
And I did.
Your family had connections to Lower Manhattan, to this part of the city. It's a part you knew well.
I knew it well. It was not something I had to research. As I said, my father worked in a printing factory on Stone Street. My brother-in-law worked in the towers for the Port Authority as an engineer. And I myself went to school and studied architecture at Cooper Union, really not far from that site. We used to go there almost weekly to see this incredible foundation and incredible controversial buildings being built.
You write that your philosophy of architecture is influenced by your personal history, as anyone's life and work would be. Parents as Holocaust survivors, the Jewish history through World War II, and longer than that, of course, in Europe. You say you've thought a lot about matters like trauma and memory. When you began to think about that site in Lower Manhattan, trauma against an American backdrop, New York, as you said earlier, this kind of bursting with energy, long a symbol of optimism. How did you pull those two ideas together? Clearly there was a trauma here suddenly, but in a context that was American.
It was. And, you know, what gave me the kind of revelation or a clue to how to deal with the problem is when I actually descended physically into the bedrock of Ground Zero. I asked the Port Authority if I could go down. And I went, and it was, as I describe in the book, as if I was diving to the bottom of the ocean with the pressure sort of in my ears and in my heart as I went deeper and deeper into where the catastrophe was rooted. And I touched the slurry wall, which is a technical name for this great foundation wall that has been exposed during the attack. Mm. But also I suddenly realized this living wall was holding the waters of the Hudson River from flooding all of New York subways. And had this wall collapsed, there would have been a real apocalypse. And yet this wall, with its eloquence, was both something so tragic, but also as eloquent as the Constitution of America about what people can do in a city that believes in a future. And that was really the moment where I saw the light of the Wedge of Light, where I understood that the site would have to be treated both as an eternal memory of the tragedy, but also a resurgence of Manhattan, resurgence of New York into a free sky, affirming all those values that we do find self-evident.
We're talking with Daniel Liebskind, master plan architect for the World Trade Center site in New York. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Joe's calling from New York City. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Your show gets better and better.
Oh, thank you, my friend.
And I've met you sometime back, but when I was working on the Today Show.
Great.
I love to hear your show. It's really, really wonderful.
Thank you so
much. Anyhow, what a terrific guest, and what an interesting man. The thing, you know, you asked at some point in your setup for this piece that should one man be trusted, this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I mean, nothing that's ever been done that's great has ever been done by a committee. It all has to do with a person's dream, and Liebskind is a dreamer. How wonderful. And his design is about dreaming and reaching and striving and trying to be. It's in some ways it's the antithesis of what the towers were architecturally, and I'm delighted because I watched that being built too, and got more and more dismayed as they went up. But this is not about just a memorial. Yes, it's a memorial, but it's about where we go from here. It's not just about the past.
But, Joe, you know well, as a New Yorker, the very public trials that went on over this design, it is clearly no longer one man's vision. But do you still see the original impulse in there working for you when you see it?
Well, I hope so. And I hope that, I believe that a great idea can carry us forward. And he has a great idea. And I hope that the forces of mediocrity and sameness. And Jane Jacobs said, America has two great things they've given to the world.
Mm.
Her songs and her cities. And the best of her cities is about their messiness and their spirit, and not about their, where everything is the same and looks the same, and these great committee-designed plazas that we all abhor and that nobody uses.
Joe, we've got it, and it's good to hear from you. Thanks so much for calling. Let us pick it up. Daniel Liebskind, how about it? It was your vision at the beginning. It was a committee effort by the end or something like that. What do you think of the process?
No, I believe in the process. Really, you know, visionaries are not demented idiots. Visionaries are realists. True visions get realized in the world, and I believe they get realized because of the process. And I describe in the book that the process is complex. It's not just walking into a room and saying, do this and do this. I don't believe in strong hands and strong powers to say, we're going to build this and it's done. I saw that in Potsdamer Platz in Berlin, where there were great architects from all over the world brought in. Strong authorities said, do this. Everybody did the same thing. And it's a mediocre, sad place. So I never wanted to create a project that was just me. I'm going to do this. And if you note the finalist projects, mine was the only one that did not depend on a single architect doing everything. Mm-hmm. All the other megastructures had to be about one architect. I designed a neighborhood. And I believe that a neighborhood open to the Hudson River, which has the spirituality of the memorial, but also rising to the Freedom Tower in the spiral, which encircles the memorial and puts life back into streets, unashamedly New York, with culture at the center, is a response that is not mediocre, that is not really compromised in a negative way, but of course has to undergo a challenging process. And think about it. If you take an oil press or a wine press, mm-hmm. and you start squeezing the oil, you put it under great pressure. And what happens is the world is under pressure, just like an oil press. In every book that I've ever read, in the Bible, in the New Testament, everything is under pressure all the time. There are wars, there are crimes, there are bad people. But you have to put yourself into that pressure and resist the pressure. And the friction of the pressure eliminates the extra, the dregs. And what survives is the essential core of an idea, of a spirit. And I believe I have put my project into the press, into the pressure of what New York has always been and always will be. And I think out of it, I'm not a pessimist. I'm an optimist. I believe that this public project will lead the project not into mediocrity, but will affirm the things that I drew into the project and the things that I showed in the models.
But when you call the process challenging, as I read your description of it, that sounds like such an understatement. Of course, you did the master plan, and of course, it's as you write, it's common for a master planner to get at least one of the major elements of the project, very likely the main tower. When you met with Larry Silverstein and you asked him if you would be one of the architects doing one of the towers, and he said to you, as you quote him, "I don't want you, Daniel Liebskin, I don't want you touching my building." What a way to begin for the master planner.
Well, look, it was not a pleasant beginning, but I was lucky to have other people, the governor, the mayor, other people who believed in the plan and who did represent the public good and who are not only about private development. And the plan is about public spaces. It's about the wedge of light, about the memorial, about streets, and about shaping buildings that are no longer just putting shadows on the streets and disconnecting the city, but creating connectivity so that it becomes part of something important in Lower Manhattan. Let's not forget that Lower Manhattan was brutally damaged in this attack, and we have to restore not only buildings, but the spirit of people living there, jobs, a whole new era for Lower Manhattan to rise out of this disaster. And my optimism is verified by the figures. Today, there are more people living in Lower Manhattan than there were before 9/11. There is a spirit. People want to come back. They want to see something positive happen. And that heroic day for those who perished will not be in vain.
People living near there, including you. You've recently bought a place within eyeshot of the World Trade Center site. Is that right?
Absolutely. I see it out of my window, out of my bedroom, out of my living room. I see it from the south side from my office. I want to be there. I want to see it go up.
Alex is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Alex. You're on the air.
How's it been? I've been listening to your show for about, 30 minutes. I went to get dinner and found out that it was on. There's a couple questions that I had.
Yeah.
Though I do greatly admire the concept of taking a memorial building for one of the greatest tragedies that has happened in American history, there's two points that I thought were rather valid. One is that wouldn't it have been much more of a meaningful statement if we were to just put the buildings back up as they were?
You mean the same towers, just right back up?
The same towers. Use the original blueprints, put it back up, say, we will not be terrorized. we will overcome.
But what about evolution? What about growth? What about change, even when it comes from traumatic origins, Alex?
Well, I do agree with change, but I think that there are much better venues for this change. For example, very little known fact is that you have, at the same time that 9/11 was a great tragedy and 3,000 people died in one day, in my age group, ages 18 to 28, in that same year, more people died from lack of health care. So you really have to question spending billions of dollars on creating a memorial when there are people that can be addressed with those funds.
Well, of course, it's not going to be left empty, but let us just pick up that point, Alex, and thanks for your call. Daniel Liebskin, Alex would like to see the same towers go straight back up. That's the symbolism he wants. Is nothing changed here?
No, I think you can't reverse history. We dream about it. There is a nostalgia, and I can well understand it. But we have to also learn from history, from the past. We also have to learn to make an environment better that was there before. And in fact, when the World Trade Center went up, you know that there was very little life. There was very little retail on the streets. It was hard to navigate in the mega block. The plaza was often closed in the winter because of the winds. Mm-hmm. It was impossible to be used. So I thought, let's learn something from these towers. Let's not just rebuild the towers again. Let's create buildings that do bring light to the streets, that bring life and retail, that acknowledge the disaster that happened there in a significant way, and yet show the connection of that memory to a city that understands its own future. And I think that's an organic development. And that's how the mind, the intellect, the spirit, arts, literature, even economics develop.
How would you describe the statement at the end of Manhattan that the World Trade Center towers were? And then how would you articulate the statement that you hope your design will be? What element were they in the New York skyline? What element, what note would your tower strike?
Well, the World Trade Center was an orientation point. It was so visible. It was you know, when it fell, we felt a tremendous loss, a void. Where are we? And I hope that the resurgence of Ground Zero will be both an acknowledgement of the tremendous loss. And it was a true loss because these human beings were like us. They were people who went to work that day and never returned. It could have been we who were there in their stead. So they were kind of an eternal testament to what happened on that site, and we will forever remember them. But at the same time, I think to acknowledge that loss, we have to rebuild the city not according to a previous pattern, but according to a 21st century notion of imagination, of urban space, of something that will inspire a child who walks onto these streets and says, you know, the world is a beautiful place. It has history. It has tragedy. But at the end, we can deal with it. We can heal the city. We can do something noble.
And in the kind of asymmetric elements of your design, along with David Childs, of course, we'll talk about that, but as opposed to the severe symmetry of the World Trade Center towers, is that something 21st century? And why? What is it about asymmetry?
Well, the asymmetry in the Freedom Towers, if that's what you're referring to, is
yes,
a very simple one. I wanted the tower to have certain elements that would really fit the tower into the master plan. First of all, it had to stand in the right location. I had to fight that fight. It had to stand at the apogee, at the high point of all the spiraling buildings that surround the memorial site, like a ring. And it had to be that element of expression right at the Hudson River. And that indeed is a battle, a hard one that I won. The tower was not shifted to another place, which of course the developers wanted to shift. It stayed where it is. Second element of a tower, it's its symbolism. What is its profile? What does it relate to? It's not just a building from Chicago, Hong Kong, or you know, Shanghai. It's a building that is reflective of the dynamics of the Statue of Liberty. It has the asymmetry of that torch in its antennas.
Daniel, let's hold the thought. We have to take a short break. Of course, that's the Statue of Liberty you saw immigrating to the United States. 1-800-423-825 with architect Daniel Liebskind. You can join the conversation. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Daniel Liebskind, master plan architect for the rebuilding of the World Trade Center site in New York City. You can join the conversation. What do you hear in Daniel Liebskind's philosophy of architecture? Is a battle to defend an architect's vision inevitable in such a public structure? And does Daniel Liebskind sound like the man to bind the country's wound here to design its look ahead? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Tony's calling from Montclair, New Jersey. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Good evening. I, too, was in Berlin for 9/11 and was interested in Mr. Liebskin's perspective on that city, on the scar placed on that city by the Berlin Wall and how it was reconstructed and given a new life.
Daniel Liebskin?
It's a very interesting question. Well, first of all, I just wanted to mention this slightly strange anecdote that the Jewish Museum, after 12 years of working on it, and I describe in the book the difficulties and how hard it was to build this building because of what it stands for and its hope that it gives to the city. The building finally opened, fully installed, after 12 years on September 11th, 2001.
With the long lines waiting to come in and see this remarkable structure.
And then it closed.
So long in the
making. And then it closed. And I thought, how strange. Here I thought an era of something so negative was kind of over. And suddenly something horrible opened up again. The catastrophe of what happened in New York. But I understand that Berlin, of course, suffered. And the Berlin Wall was a tremendous scar. But what was interesting to me is that the Berlin Wall, the minute unification happened, disappeared overnight. Bulldozer just took it down. And suddenly, a few years later, people were asking, where is the Berlin Wall? Where is the trace of that whole history that we suffered? And now, ironically, the Germans had to rebuild inauthentically, artificially, pieces of the Berlin Wall because they didn't think that the absence is also part of a presence of a city. So again, in Ground Zero, I did not fill the memorial site. I left a vast portion of that site really empty for the memorial. It's almost 5 acres long out of the 16 acres. And it's not just two-dimensional, but it really goes to bedrock because I think we want to feel the impact of that void forever.
And you wanted the actual slurry wall to be visible in the ultimate development, redevelopment. Will it be?
It will be. Absolutely. It's a living memorial unlike any other because we know of ancient walls, of fragments of ruins in Rome or Greece or wherever we've been. But this is not an old wall. It's a living wall. It freezes in the winter. It breathes in the summer. It reacts to the Hudson River. And I thought, what an incredible thing. It's the first memorial to life, which this wall also shows in its tragic exposure, but it also in its fact that it remains the foundation wall of the entire site.
Peter's calling from Winchester, Massachusetts. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you, Tom. Phone's about to die, so I'm going to make it quick.
Okay.
I think I'm calling in reaction to Alex, who wanted the towers rebuilt as they were. I think that we learned a very valuable lesson about that from Virgil in the Aeneid when Aeneas was traveling from Troy, from the ashes of Troy, and he came across an island whose name escapes me now, but the occupants of the island had rebuilt a model of Troy. But they hadn't, what was significant about that is that they had not moved, they were living in the past, really. And but from the ashes of Troy came Rome, which was the second of the three greatest societies of all time. And I think it gives us a very poignant lesson in what happens when a city falls and is remade again. My phone's beeping now, so I think I have to go.
But dive in, creative. Don't hold on to that old. Peter, thanks very much for your call. Daniel Liebskin, you write that one day, when your children have children and you're a wise old grandfather, you want to entertain them, perhaps, with the story of your forced marriage, as you call it, to Larry Silverstein's architect, David Childs. You say that the story, once you've finally figured out how to shape it, will be Homeric, Shakespearean, a little bit of Lewis Carroll, Alice in Wonderland. And when you finish the story, you'll say to your grandchildren, what madness that men behave this way. What was the essential madness, in your word, of that relationship, that collaboration?
Well, the madness was that instead of the collaboration being a true collaboration, it devolved into, as I described, something like North Korean, South Korean border, you know, between in Panmunjom, the kind of tension between two opposing sides. And, you know, it's not about the egos of the architect in this case. It's not about people wanting to assert their designs. It's about what is best for the site, what best fits the site, and what befits the level of this event in terms of rebuilding New York and this site. And I felt that, throughout that process, it was kind of like Alice in Wonderland. I never knew where people were heading and what they were saying and why they were doing what they were doing. But at the end, of course, the fight and the struggle was worth it because I stood proudly with SOM and with investors and with the governor, with the mayor. And at the end, I think the tower, albeit a compromise, is a good compromise. It keeps its word. It keeps its mission in the position of where it's located. And it keeps its significance. It's never going to be surpassed because it's not a trick to build just a high tower. It can exist anywhere. But a tower that will always mean something to us when we look at it will always remind us that all men are created equal and that the founders of this country inscribed into this constitution things that are so miraculous, such as liberty and equality and all the things that we many people dream around the world and don't have. I think that's significant and was worth the struggle.
You quote Hebrews 11 in your book, Daniel Liebskin, saying, "Now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen." You say, for an architect, these words are profound. How so for you?
Well, because every architect begins with a drawing, begins with an idea, something which hasn't yet been built. And to build something, you depend on faith, not just your own faith, the faith of the world, because that faith guarantees that your hope has a substance to it. And of course, every architect and every dreamer and every musician, composer, everyone who's doing something valuable has to pour their heart into it. And that pouring of the heart and that commitment is the faith that that humanity ultimately will prevail and that objects diversions will be subsumed by human desire to make them meaningful.
Daniel Liebskin, thank you for your work and thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me.
Daniel Liebskin, master plan architect for the World Trade Center site in Manhattan, author of the new book, Breaking Ground, Adventures in Life and Architecture. You can see images of Liebskin's World Trade Site rendering and the Jewish Museum Berlin at onpointradio.org. You can continue this conversation online as well at onpointradio.org and click on forums there. In a moment, remembering Harvard psychiatrist and researcher of alien abductees, John Mack. This is On Point. John Mack, the Harvard psychiatrist who became renowned for his controversial research of people who claimed to have been abducted by aliens, died Monday when he was struck by an alleged drunken driver in London. He was 74. Mack won a Pulitzer Prize for his 1977 biography of the World War I British soldier T.E. Lawrence, who became known as Lawrence of Arabia. But it was his later research of purported alien abductees and extraterrestrial UFOs that earned him international fame and no little scorn from colleagues. In 1994, Harvard Medical School launched a 14-month investigation of Mack's body of research, ultimately concluding that he deserved to retain his tenure, but his skeptics were many. Before his death, Mack had interviewed and counseled hundreds of people who claimed they had been abducted by space aliens. John Mack spoke to On Point in June of 2002. Tonight, we bring you his 2002 radio diary, where he described his extraterrestrial research.
I'm a psychiatrist, and I lived with the notion that there was no other intelligence in the universe that wasn't a projection of the human brain, or if there was, it had to be proven, and we hadn't proven it. So when I first heard about somebody who, in New York, who had worked with people that experienced themselves as having encounters with strange beings from we know not where, and that there were thousands of these people, apparently, all over the country who didn't know each other, I thought this must be some kind of a new psychiatric syndrome. One of the things that convinced me as a clinician that this was not the product of somebody's imagination or something that came from fantasy or dreams was that these stories that I was hearing were consistent among many, many people from all of the United States and many other countries who had no contact with each other, who, when I started at least, knew nothing of any media descriptions that fit what they were undergoing whatsoever. And the only thing that I know as a clinician that acts like that, that is, people having an experience that many other people are having too, is that something really is happening. The basic story is that a person is in their home, or they're in a car, or in the case of children in the schoolyard, and they hear a buzzing sound, or they see a strange light. They may see something like what we call a UFO up close, but they begin to have some kind of memories of something that happened, and it's not like a dream. They really, it's a memory of something that occurred in their conscious experience of seeing some sort of strange beings, of being taken somewheres, of having their bodies poked or probed, of some kind of reproductive element in this, of being given information about and images of what's happening to the earth, sometimes a feeling that they're being brought home in the sense of a deep spiritual kind of connection. There is physical evidence. In other words, people have been observed, or the children have come into their parents' room when they're missing. I don't believe in every case the person is physically taken someplace. That is yet to be established, although it appears that happens on occasion. But there may be marks on their bodies, which little lesions or cuts or scoop marks, which correspond to what they remember happening to them during the experience. People may see a UFO near where the person having the experience has been undergoing the experience. Many people in the community may see some kind of bright lights that relate to the experience, not just the person who's having the encounter. The physical evidence is not strong enough for it to be proof. On the other hand, it's dangerous to dismiss this because we can't prove it by our methods of three-dimensional science. In other words, we need to be able to expand how we know to include valid human experience, but that has to be looked at rigorously as well. One of the things that convinced me, again, that I was dealing with some kind of genuine mystery here was that the people seemed to have nothing in common one with another. There was no way to typecast the individuals. There was no personality consistency, no socioeconomic consistency, nothing about their point of view. They were almost without exception strangers to the phenomenon. And when it happened, they were as shocked as anybody else. And they would be sometimes come to me in the hope that I could somehow explain this away psychiatrically. They would prefer a psychiatric explanation than that this is somehow real and they have to contend with the shattering of their worldview as well as the distress of the experiences. I believe that if we can open ourselves to the possibility that we don't live alone in this cosmos, we're not the only intelligence. If we can open our hearts to an expanded notion of who we are, we might treat each other better. We might treat the earth better. We might be open to sacred realities, to the sacredness of all life. Because that seems to be what happens to these experiencers when they open up, when they go through the dark night of the soul of their encounters and begin to grasp the truth of it. So I think it has some creative possibilities for our consciousness.
Harvard psychiatrist John Mack from a 2002 interview. John Mack died Monday after being struck by a car in London. He was 74. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.